And Your Honors, I'd like to reserve, I guess, 5 minutes for rebuttal. Good afternoon, Your Honors. James Hopkins, lawyer for Guy Lucero. The discretion in a 35B setting is using the law and the facts that are old at the time in 35B, and also using the law and the facts that are new. 35B, I mean, reconsideration really covers it. It is basically a second sentencing hearing in most ways, making sure that a sentence is just and appropriate for that particular defendant and those particular set of facts. In this case, this means that Graham, which was new law at the time, was part of the new information that the court should rely on. Doesn't mean the court necessarily had to follow it, but it needed to address it. And for a 35B court to exercise discretion, they have to make findings. Doesn't have to be in great detail, but they need to address what is before them. And under this case, Graham, and the fact that we had a juvenile who had been sentenced as an adult, presented a special set of circumstances to the trial court. They needed to address Graham because it had been raised in the 35B motion. It had been raised orally at the 35B hearing, and there was no stance taken by the trial court on Graham. Now, the AG may argue that they implicitly took a stance with their ruling. But what Graham does is clarify the law of the land. The U.S. Supreme Court had issued Roper v. Simmons. They'd taken a stance on how juveniles need to be sentenced, different from adults. And this case is a case where we have a juvenile being tried as an adult, and the court had that second chance, the 35B hearing, to make sure that the sentence was appropriate. And what Graham does is clarify how to apply the penological goals as to juveniles.
Counsel, doesn't Graham establish a categorical rule?
Graham does that, but it doesn't only do that. Graham makes it illegal to give a juvenile a technical life sentence, meaning an actual life sentence without parole, if they did not cause a death. But it also goes into why they make that categorical rule. And when the Supreme Court discusses the ruling, because that's what they were faced with in Graham, they talk about how we apply penological goals to juveniles, how we take 18.1, 102.5, and all those purposes of sentencing and apply them to juveniles as opposed to adults. Mm-hmm. And Graham gave excellent guidance on what Roper before it meant when it comes to looking at the case of a juvenile.
So, counsel, do you think that Graham established a new rule of constitutional procedure or simply extended a rule that Roper had already created or something else?
Well, I think it's a combination, Your Honor. It definitely, and let me make sure I understand the question. Are you talking specifically about 35B, or are we talking about juvenile sentencing in general?
I'm asking about Graham. Do you think that Graham established a new rule of constitutional procedure, or simply applied existing law to a new set of facts?
I think Graham did create a new rule of constitutional procedure as it applies to sentencing juveniles.
And do you think that that new rule should apply retroactively to your client's conviction, and if so, why?
Well, I absolutely do think it should apply retroactively. And we now, even though Miller, and I get my case names mixed up here, but Miller v. Alabama wasn't available this time, that has explicitly been made retroactive. And Graham is more than just saying we can't sentence a juvenile to life unless they took a life, which has been expanded by Miller at this point. Now, we can't sentence juveniles to life, period. But Graham is saying juveniles have to be treated differently. And when we're looking at the purposes of the sentencing code, whatever state that may be, but here in Colorado, we have to look at those purposes and take into account how a child or an adolescent is different from an adult in applying those penological goals. And I think that is the constitutional mandate that Graham gives. Roper made a very important finding. Graham expanded that finding. It made a specific rule as to one thing we absolutely cannot do with juveniles. But it also discussed why we have to treat juveniles different, and it took it further than Roper. It built on Roper. And I think it should be retroactive. We're facing an unusual set of circumstances in this case because we don't have a technical life sentence. We have what I refer to in the brief as a virtual life sentence or an effective life sentence. It's highly unlikely my client will ever walk outside the walls of the Department of Corrections. If he lives long enough, the possibility is certainly there. But when you factor in things like life expectancy, and you factor in how young my client was, how young guy was when he started his sentence, he really will be lucky if he spends any significant portion of his life outside of the walls of a prison.
Is there any evidence in the record regarding life expectancy?
Aside from what I supply to the court by citing to the World Bank website, and I actually spent quite a bit of time trying to find reliable data for life expectancy, and there was not a lot that I could find. It was easy to find life expectancy. It was hard to factor in the life that someone lives inside of a Department of Corrections facility and how that statistically affects. And the most recent information that I could find, I think it was back in 1996 or the mid-90s, which said that for every 20 years, you effectively lose 16 years of life expectancy for every 20 years spent in DOC, which is a drastic amount of life expectancy.
Well, normally evidence like that has to be offered to the trial court. And so there's an opportunity for the trial court to evaluate it. Here, the trial court could not have evaluated that information.
I agree with that.
And the prosecution didn't have an opportunity to rebut it or cross-examine. And in fact, it's not even before us, other than in your brief. So I don't know how are we to go about dealing with life expectancy, other than perhaps to accept your concession in the brief that 75 is the life expectancy.
Well, you know, Your Honors, I think one of my concerns in writing the brief is that even though this is not a life sentence handed to a juvenile where it says you must spend the rest of your life in prison without the ability of parole, it was important to me to communicate to this court that we are still, whether it's technically a life sentence or not, likely throwing away any opportunity that this young person has to reintegrate with society and provide something positive instead of just the negative things they've been able to do early on in their life. And I don't think that Your Honors have to take my word for it. I think that judges with your level of experience in the justice system can come to your own conclusion about what Guy Lucero's chances are of ever getting out of prison.
Doesn't that depend on so many different factors, though? If we're to make a judgment that because he can conceivably get out of prison before his life expectancy is reached, how are we supposed to reason where the number ought to be and how we ought to go about making that choice?
No, I'm not going to jerk the court around here at all. I don't know that I have a clear answer to that.
Well, does Graham answer that for us? I don't think it does.
I think what Graham does, and I agree, I don't think Graham does answer that. What Graham does is provide guidance on how to assess to the best of a trial court's ability by applying the penological goals with respect to juveniles, how to do that.
So let me just explore that a little bit. Are you asking for a remand from us to the trial court to say to the trial court, expressly consider the fact that Mr. Lucero was 15 when he committed this crime, he's 17 when he was sentenced, and expressly consider that Graham says life without parole sentences are unconstitutional? What do you want from us, and what do you want us to direct the trial court to do? Because I'm not sure how the trial court can do any better job that with what it gets than what we have. And we're sort of just left in limbo. We're not quite sure.
Well, what the basis of this appeal is the trial court failed to exercise discretion by not addressing Graham and applying it to the facts of that case. And they hadn't had Graham at the time of sentencing. By not doing that, I don't know, you know, and maybe we could guess at what the trial court would have done, because they were harsh with my client, with Guy Lucero. But without applying Graham and explaining how the penological goals, as described in Graham, and how those are described to apply to juveniles specifically, without doing that, the trial court has put Guy Lucero in prison, we don't have to say for life, but for a long, long time, without addressing his juvenile status at the time he committed the crime the way Graham requires. And Graham is very specific about how each of the penological goals should apply to juveniles.
Well, but it doesn't. I agree that there are a number of goals that it goes through in the discussion, but it essentially is saying this goal can't be realized or fleshed out by a life without parole sentence. This goal can't be realized. I mean, it goes through and it negatively analyzes it by saying you can't justify the sentence based on this factor. But it doesn't say, gosh, if you had said 5 years less than somebody's life expectancy is okay or not. How's the trial court supposed to make this decision?
The trial court has broad discretion, especially at sentencing, maybe more than any other phase of trial. But the law is clear that they have to exercise discretion. And I argue especially when dealing with juveniles being sentenced as adults. The law requires the court to look at the broader picture, to look at any promise they can see with a child, to look at what's been holding that child back. And they can do this with adults, but the emphasis has been placed on a sentencing court by this chain of case law, by Roper. Yes, sir.
Didn't the trial, I realize the trial court did not take up your Graham argument, or trial counsel's Graham argument directly, but she made it very clear that she took the age of the defendant into account in sentencing. I realize she made a misstatement that she said she sentenced him in the lower range when in fact it was in the mid-range, but the fact is she could have given a much more severe sentence that would have, maybe it would have made your current case easier, but it would have, he would say it would be 126, 128 years,
right.
I think, which would have meant he would not have been eligible for parole until he was 99 or something.
Sure.
But instead, she did make it less than the maximum, substantial less than the maximum. And so she took the age into account. She also took into account her assessment of his, of some of the other factors that are described, right? Even though she didn't talk about Grant. I mean, currently, my question is getting a little out of hand. What is it you expect her to do that she didn't already do?
Well, for one, make specific findings on how Graham applies to the facts of Guy Lucero's case and his sentencing situation. And they don't have to be expansive, but at a minimum, the court needed to address Graham.
But what do you want to happen? What do you want to happen? What would be a sentence that you would deem to be constitutional?
Well, clearly I'm not a judge, and I'm probably biased, because I represent juveniles on a regular basis at both trial and the appellate level. And I think any kind of sentence to prison, an adult prison for somebody who's under the age of 18 years, is questionable at best. But talking length of years, God, we sort of missed the opportunity because of how long the 35B took to go to YLS. That's what I thought would have been appropriate. So the lowest sentence allowed under the law for Fabucero. And under the sentence that he received, he could have even been sentenced to probation on the resentencing of the 35B. So that's what I would argue is appropriate for a young person who has shown potential, not been perfect, but had a support system waiting for him on the outside, did not take a life, and had a lot of mitigating circumstances for a 15-year-old at the time of the crime. Sending a child to adult prison is just...
Counsel, can I clarify something to make sure I understand your position?
Sure.
At least one of the holdings, and arguably the only holding of Graham, was that it prohibited life without the possibility of parole for juveniles who did not commit homicide. As to that holding, do you think your client's sentence violates that holding of Graham?
I argue that it does. And
Because you argue this is, in effect, a life without parole sentence.
Correct, sir.
Okay. And do you think the trial court needs to make findings about life expectancy, et cetera, of your client in order for us to buy your presentation?
Well, I do think if the things that I argued about the length of sentence and the fact that it's a virtual life sentence, I do think that if I had been the trial lawyer, I would have tried to force the court to make findings on that. Whether I would have been successful, who knows? But I do think if this case were remanded for another 35B finding, that certainly should be required, that the trial court make a finding why this does not amount to a life sentence, or why something that does amount to a life sentence is appropriate. And I'm not sure I ever answered this question before, but talking about, is this really a life sentence? I think it's important to use the common knowledge, to use your own life experience and ask yourself, is an 84-year sentence for someone's first chance for parole when going into prison at 15 is, I think, if I remember right, the age of 57, is that a life sentence? Not technically.
Well, I don't think my common experience would necessarily tell me that 57 is beyond a life sentence, is a life sentence either.
Are there any cases that you've located? You didn't cite any. That where a court has held that a release at age 50, an opportunity for release at age 57 is not compliant with Graham?
No, Your Honor. And I don't think there is a case that would say that. I mean, Graham right now is too new, and I think in Colorado, this is the first case of its kind. I think this, I don't want to say the first case ever, but the first case that I know of that's going up on appeal right now that is dealing with a lengthy sentence that one can argue is equivalent to a life sentence. And I don't have any case law on that whatsoever.
Mr. Hopkins, I'll remind you have a minute and 30 at this point.
I'll reserve the rest for you, by the way. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, and may it please the court. John Lee, on behalf of people, bar number 38141. Current P35B is discretionary in nature. It affords trial court the opportunity to reduce a moving defendant's sentence. Reflecting the wide discretion that the rule provides the trial court, appellate review of a current P35 proceeding is exceedingly narrow. As articulated by the Supreme Court in Nicholson and applied by this court in Bush and Olivas, the intrinsic fairness of the sentence cannot be reviewed. Instead, a reviewing court is limited to determining whether the trial court exercised its discretion.
Does CRIM P35B trump a constitutional declaration by the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think it's an issue of how, whether the claim is properly presented. So certainly, the nature of the relief before us wouldn't preclude a defendant from raising an alternative avenue. But it does limit the court's review to the extent that is how this case came to the court. It was presented as a 35B motion, not as a constitutional claim. It was appealed as a 35B motion.
Well, counsel, he would agree that it could have been brought as a 35C motion.
Perhaps, except for generally speaking, yes.
And I know you have a number of, I'm sorry.
That's it.
As opposed to, just as a question of whether or not it can be brought as on a post-conviction basis, not with all your other defenses you have. But it could be brought as 35C because 35C specifically authorizes a post-conviction challenge to the constitutionality of a sentence, right?
Yes, as a general matter, absolutely.
And so is there any reason why, if it's not admissible, if it's not appropriate under 35B, we can't consider it under 35C?
I think in this case, perhaps just given the fact that this has been already raised on direct appeal, an Eighth Amendment claim, challenging the sentence, so in that
before, respect, before Graham was decided, though.
It would still be a successive claim under current B35C. But to the extent that this court finds that Graham creates an independent avenue of relief and creates an unconstitutional sentence in which to review it, I'd be happy to address that.
Okay.
So I think whether we look at this as a constitutional claim or as a current B35B motion, I think the defendant's argument is the same, in that he received a sentence of life without the possibility of parole, and under Graham, the trial court was required to make additional findings. That is a two-step argument that we submit to wrong both steps. First, the defendant did not receive a sentence of life without parole. There's no dispute that he's eligible for parole at 57. So, just as a factual matter, the cases he cites are completely distinguishable. Legally, whether Graham applies or not, again, this case presents facts entirely different from Graham, does not trigger its application. As this court has pointed out, the holding in Graham was that a court cannot sentence a non-homicide offender, juvenile, to life without the possibility of parole. Here, not only was the defendant not sentenced to life without parole, he also was convicted of a homicide offense.
So he was convicted of a homicide offense?
He was. For the purposes of the Eighth Amendment, yes.
An attempt to murder?
Yes, attempt to murder, and also conspiracy to murder, which under my reading of Graham does constitute a homicide offense under the Eighth Amendment.
Did you make that argument in your brief? I didn't see it, so I'd be happy to look at it again.
I believe I said that Graham did not apply. I did not specify the grounds for why attempted murder is specifically not a homicide offense, or is a homicide offense for the person they put on it.
Mr. Lee, what would you do with a sentence to a juvenile of 200 years of imprisonment and with not a statement that it's without parole, but just a statement of a term of years for 200 years? Would you say that's life without parole?
200 years, perhaps, yes. And I guess I would qualify that with that still might be a possible sentence if the defendant was convicted of a homicide offense. But for a non-homicide offense, then 200 years, possibly. But 57 years old, obviously not.
Well, but even under a homicide offense, he would be
under Miller, he would be allowed at least. The statute would be simple on the trial court. The definite decide whether or not to impose that sentence.
Right. And under Banks, the court held that being eligible for parole in 40 years would be satisfactory for a homicide defense.
Yes, I mean, Colorado, I think, is unique in that regard, and that we have that statute for juveniles, which I think completely comports with Graham's, as a vision this court has already found. So, given that Graham has no application to this case, and given the exceptionally narrow grounds of which this case reaches this court, if this court has no further questions.
I think we do.
Well, I'm happy to hear.
Let's assume that we disagree with you, just for purposes of argument here, and we decide that the trial court improperly under Crim B 35B didn't consider Graham, so it's a defect in the hearing procedure itself. And we say it's got to be returned to the trial court. What would you say the trial court ought to do?
Okay, well, I guess I'm going to have a hard time answering that question because I disagree with the premise.
I understand.
That Graham requires, or that Graham requires the trial court to make additional findings.
Okay.
Under Graham, it's even more dealing with the Eighth Amendment. There's really two different lines of jurisprudence. One is the Graham line, the other is the Ewing one that we talked about in the brief on proportionality. The Graham line is dealing, as this court's pointing out, with categorical rules. You cannot do this categorically to this class of defendants. So in that regard, it did not create, in those later sections that my opposing counsel was discussing, it wasn't creating additional factors that a trial court had to consider. It was just saying why categorically the sentence that it was prohibiting could not ever apply. So on that question, even if this court were to conclude, I don't think this court could conclude that a remand would be necessary for the trial court to make additional findings under Graham, because Graham does not require a trial court to make any findings.
You seem to recognize that Graham drew this distinction between a disproportionality review of a term of years and this categorical rule against the life sentence for juveniles. Yet you seem to rely on Close, the state Supreme Court decision, which follows the line of the disproportionality review and seems to be inapplicable to the categorical bar that Graham has announced. Now, assuming for the moment that I think Graham would apply because this is not a homicide offense, doesn't that make your reliance on Close inapplicable to Graham?
I would say one under U.S. Supreme Court case law, I guess it's still a little unclear to the extent. There are two different analyses, but the extent I used it in the brief, it was that each sentence for purposes of the Eighth Amendment needs to be looked at per crime.
Right, but that's assuming we're following the analysis of Close to following the Hamlin analysis. And
yeah.
But if we're not, if we're saying Graham applies, which is an entirely different analysis, as you've noted, why would Close be relevant?
Oh, I guess what I was trying to say was they're different. They hold different things, they're different ways to review, but they're not necessarily inconsistent. So I do think one thing that has been left open by Graham is whether or not you look at the sentences individually or not. Because there's no conflict, I think, in the two different avenues of the U.S. Supreme Court case lines of whether or not you couldn't have an additional Hamlin factor also become part of the analysis in Graham. That when we're looking at whether a punishment is categorically improper, you would still just look at it case specific. You look at the sentence and you look at the conviction and the sense of which the defendant received, and you do it in isolation, which is what they did in Hamlin. And I don't necessarily see those two things as being inconsistent.
Well, but in Graham, the majority concluded that it's just not very possible for a court to determine whether a defendant, a juvenile, is incorrigible at such a young age. And Justice Roberts wrote a concurrence, I think, from Chief Justice Roberts, saying, well, I think we can, and that's what we should do. But he only got one vote, and five votes went the other way. So isn't that kind of inconsistent with your view that courts should be allowed to decide on a case-by-case basis whether or not an effective life sentence should be imposed?
Not necessarily, because that was just one of the grounds for why the set for why the Graham, the majority of Graham, or the bigger majority of Graham, held the way it did was because it sounded generally that because you know they're less culpable, you cannot provide them with the harshest of sentences. It then went through the other two factors, that being retribution and the other penological goals. Those two factors, I think, necessarily could include, depending on if the juvenile defendant committed multiple crimes in separate episodes, it could weigh those factors in favor.
Well, but of course, the rehabilitation factor wouldn't apply because if they're in life without parole, society doesn't have a reason to want to rehabilitate the incarcerated person.
Right? Yeah, I guess it could be on the other side of rehabilitation that if a defendant committed multiple crimes in different episodes, the likelihood of rehabilitation could weigh in favor of a longer prison sentence. But I guess just thinking up here, I guess maybe a better answer to your question, and I could reframe it, would be that when we're considering consecutive sentences, because I guess now really the question is, can you consider independent convictions when you're dealing with an effective life sentence as opposed to an actual life sentence? So I'm saying, I think in that regard, to the extent it's still effective, that it's not a per se life sentence. You could look at the crimes individually and we're not being consistent with Graham.
You didn't take a position on retroactivity in your brief. Do you have a position on retroactivity?
Our office is not taking a position. Some courts have said it applies, some courts have said it's not. I'm not going to take a position today.
Okay.
I would say that I do think this case is unique, given the fact that the defendant did raise this Eighth Amendment issue. I mean, obviously, none of your grants haven't come out yet, but he did raise it on a rule on direct appeal and it has already been rejected.
You also argue in your brief that this challenge should be barred on race judicata grounds. But I think you rely primarily on civil cases. Are there any Colorado reported decisions that hold a race judicata or claim preclusion can be applied against a defendant in a criminal case?
Not to my knowledge, but I think generally the issue is whether or not the factors apply, and if they do, they should. But I will recognize that in Colorado's, at least on public decisions, actively applied it, to my knowledge.
So can I ask you again about the retroactivity question to make sure I understood you correctly? You're saying your office is not taking a position of a law granted before that applies retroactively to convictions that were final before it was announced?
That's my understanding, yes.
So you have no objection to our finding it applying retroactively?
I have. Well, I guess the issue in this case is I don't think it applies at all, so the retroactivity issue isn't really
applicable. Well, I'm asking you about the retroactivity question. You don't have a position. You're not objecting to the notion that it could apply retroactively.
Well, I guess under Graham, there's really... I guess I'm confused by the question because I don't know what would apply retroactively in Graham. Because the defendant is not...
Because Graham announced a categorical bar on life sentences without the possibility of parole for non-homicide offenders to refusals. Do you consider that to be a new rule of constitutional procedure, and if so, does it apply retroactively?
Well, I guess I'll just go back to my original answer of the defendant did not receive a prison of life, did not receive a sentence of life without parole, and he was convicted of a homicide offense. So I don't know how it would apply.
Okay, so let's be clear, you're not raising a retroactivity defense.
I'm not this time.
Okay.
And I'm sorry if I was unclear on that.
So if we apply it, we're not going against your wishes because you haven't made that argument.
I did not raise that in my brief, no, Your Honor.
What's your position on the statistical evidence that the defendant has raised?
My position would be that nothing in Graham suggests that it applies on an individualized basis. The language it uses is that it found unconstitutional what it terms to be the second most severe punishment that could be imposed on juveniles. Again, when we're dealing with these economic cases, it's a category and it was a class. By sentencing a juvenile to life without parole was tantamount to a death sentence because they're going to die in prison. It did not create an individualized or subjective test. And generally, Eighth Amendment does not create a subjective or an individualized test that it imposes on other courts. And I guess I'd also add to that I think it's dangerous to hold that life expectancy is a relevant factor that could actually be workable or wise in any given context. Life expectancy, of course, is just the average of a given population of how long the average of all the people in the population are going to live. It doesn't say much of the people who are at the bottom or the people who are on the top. And again, there's so many factors that could play on any one person's given life expectancy. I just think it's an absolutely unworkable rule.
You and I have already addressed this question, and I apologize if I missed your answer, but if we had a term of years here, we got a term of years, which is clearly beyond the life expectancy of any human that we know, would you say that Graham could apply to that situation, even though the term of years, say, was 150 years?
Possibly. I think it was a per se number, then yes.
A per se number?
Yeah, a number, again, like you said, a number that we could all agree is a number beyond someone would actually be able.
So in that scenario, we could take account of a life expectancy of an average human.
But again, it'd still be within the category because that's a category which no one can ever.
Which we know because we're taking account of the life expectancy of a human.
Yes, on the narrow grounds, I agree.
So if we decide, if we agree with you in that scenario that Graham would apply to that kind of situation, why should we not conclude that it applies to a situation where we have multiple sentences that are run consecutively, which add up to 150 years? And there's no possibility of parole before, let's say, 150 years have elapsed.
I guess I just said, I don't know how desirable it is, but just, I mean, Graham didn't say that. And to the extent that...
But how is it different from the position that you've conceded that Graham does apply to? You've conceded that Graham applies to a sentence of 150 years. If you concede that, why would it not apply to two sentences of 75 years to run consecutively?
Well, it just, it goes back to the earlier discussion we had of whether or not you can import that Harlan factor and still be consistent with Graham, of whether or not you can still look at them individually without violating the rationale of Graham. And I just think that that's still on the table. Of course, is that for the questions?
Thank you.
Is your friend Francis?
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple quick points. About the categorical ban that we have in cases like Roper and Graham and now Miller, I don't think they're that different. It's creating a bright line rule, but the purpose of that bright line rule is to say to sentencing courts, this is definitely out of bounds. But the whole point of Roper and Graham, now Miller, is to encourage the sentencing courts to look at kids and treat them like kids and not adults, even if they're charged as an adult. When sentencing time comes, the point of these cases is that you have to treat kids differently. And that's not what happened in this case. And whether we're talking about 200 years or 84 years, that's the question the court needs to be asking, because that's what Graham, in effect, is saying. It is saying, you've got to treat these kids different. Here's one thing you absolutely can't do, but look at the penological goals and apply them to kids differently.
Counsel, can I ask you a quick question before your time runs out? Do you agree that your client was convicted of a homicide offense under Graham?
No, I do not. It was attempt.
And you don't think attempted murder qualifies as a homicide offense under Graham?
I think the point of Graham is death, or you want to call it life for life, to sound a little more positive. If you take a life, you can serve a life. That's the point of Graham. It's not whether you try or not. And kids do stupid stuff. And if we treated every attempt where a kid could have killed someone, then it would be the opposite of the intention of Graham. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. That's our only case this afternoon. Court will be in recess. The date of recess.